Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office as president in 1933, he put in motion massive measures to confront the Great Depression. The New Deal was a stimulus package on the grandest of scales, and the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, one of its most ambitious programs. It put millions of Americans directly to work with shovels, paintbrushes, pens, and a paycheck from Uncle Sam. This hour, On Point, we'll look at the remarkable legacy and history of the Great Depression's WPA. Joining me now from New York is Nick Taylor, author of the new book, American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA, When FDR Put the Nation to Work. Nick Taylor, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. His father helped rebuild Fort Devens in Massachusetts as part of the WPA. Jack, that's right straight in the family.
Yeah, it sure is. It's part of the Beatty inheritance. Tom, hello, and hello to you, Nick.
Nick Taylor, thank hello, you very Jack. Much for being here today, and thanks for this new history. It's got great photographs, and by the way, you can see a selection of them at our website, onpointradio.org. They really bring back the era. And a great story of a gigantic program, hugely controversial in its day, but that touched millions and millions of Americans, put them to work, brought them some dignity. I wish, Nick, you'd begin by just painting a picture for us of the human toll that was unfolding that FDR was and the country were staring at in the early mid-1930s when the WPA was put up on the rails.
Well, first, Roosevelt took office in March of 1933, almost 75 years ago. At the time, unemployment was 25%, and that doesn't even include the farm economy, which had been devastated by droughts and years of farmers being unable to sell their crops for what they cost to grow. Mm. So Roosevelt had a big job on his hands, and his predecessor, Herbert Hoover, simply didn't believe that it was the federal government's role to help people out of their desperation. So Roosevelt had a lot on his plate when he took office. Fortunately, he had an aide named Harry Hopkins, a former social worker, who was willing to spend the government's money very, very quickly. And he first headed something called the Federal Emergency Relief Administration. In his first 2 hours on the job, he spent $5 million.
In 1933, that's a pretty good clip.
That was real money in those days. And then they realized, because you mentioned dignity, the handout didn't confer dignity on the people that took the handout.
Though the handout was the first step, the kind of dole, the direct relief was the first impulse.
That's correct. Checks as well as coupons for food and so forth. But what they really wanted to do, and also you have to remember that Roosevelt faced an infrastructure that dated to the 19th century. Probably the vast majority of rural roads in the country were not paved. Farmers couldn't get their crops to market during the rainy season, and they couldn't get their seeds back home to plant also during the rainy season. So there were great infrastructure needs that the country confronted. So Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins wanted to put people to work. They did this first temporarily in the winter of 1933-34 with the Civil Works Administration, and then in the spring of 1935, WPA was a permanent jobs program.
And remind us, because this is getting to be history that's even beyond the reach of grandparents and many people's great-grandparents at this point, remind us of the physical legacy of what was built, created by the 8.5 million, Americans who worked in the WPA.
Well, over the course of its 8 years of existence, the WPA paved or built from scratch hundreds of thousands of miles of road. It built 700 or 800 airports and improved others. It built a lot of bridges. It built schools. It built hospitals. It built a variety of public buildings. And then toward the end of its life, once Hitler had started to grasp Europe in his dictatorial claws, the WPA rebuilt the military infrastructure of the United States almost single-handedly.
We're talking here about, in the first round, LaGuardia Airport and Dealey Plaza in Dallas, the Riverwalk in San Antonio. I mean, you can go right around this Brookfield Zoo in Chicago. I guess every state in the Union with a WPA stamp somewhere within its borders.
Almost everybody who has gone to a city park or a national park, who was camped in a campground that was, you can notice these cornerstones that'll say the WPA. The dates will be 1936, 1937, 1938, 1939. But almost every community in this country has some physical reminder of the WPA that still exists today.
It was a giant program within the New Deal. FDR was talking about that already in 1932 at the Democratic National Convention in July, talking about the people America, in that very dark time economically, the people America had left behind.
I pledge myself to a New Deal for the American people. This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help. Not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
Jack Beatty, the crisis was as deep as any outside of Civil War that the country had ever known.
It was indeed, and Nick reminds us that the Federal Theater Project, which was the sort of the WPA for actors and theater people, mounted a nationwide production of It Can't Happen Here, Sinclair Lewis's play about it happening here, fascism coming to America. Well, it didn't happen here. And in the tally of positives for the WPA and other such programs, I think you have to say America stayed with democracy. Civil peace more or less reigned. And you have to imagine if there had been no such policies, if there had been no WPA, if all of those unemployed people were allowed, as Herbert Hoover said, to make the race of life all by themselves. What would have happened? We did have radicals then. We did have Huey Long. His assassination may have been providential. Who knows? But there were others. So it didn't happen here. And I think that some credit, at least, should be given to this program and others.
In that time, we had a quarter of the country's workers with no job. And given how bad the economy was, Nick Taylor reminds us, really no hope of finding one. That meant maybe 60 million people with literally no support, no money for rent, no food to feed their children, as Nick writes, no coats against the wintry cold. That was half the country, Jack, half the country without a way of putting bread on the table.
It was. And, you know, we have some vivid pictures of it. I think one of the best is in Arthur Miller's play, The Price, where one of the brothers in the play remembers walking across Grant Park in Chicago. And this would be in the last year of Hoover, and stepping by the people sleeping on the ground, and he noticed their shoes were shined. They had derby hats. They wore ties. This wasn't just something that hit the poor or the most vulnerable. This went up into the middle classes as well. It was a national trial, and the country got through it, but at what cost to people's really hope? I mean, hope was one of the first casualties, and that's, I think, exactly where the elixir of FDR's leadership came in. There was a boxcar out in Denver where the bums, the hobos, used to group, and it said, "FDR is our friend." That meant something.
Nick Taylor, did it work for dignity, putting those millions directly to work with a paycheck from Uncle Sam?
Well, it certainly did. Because of the legacy of Elizabethan poor laws in this country, people were made to feel, people who didn't have jobs and didn't have money were made to feel that it was their fault. And Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins recognized this, that the paycheck was a route to dignity. The essential thing was giving people something that they could do that they could be proud of. And, of course, if you look at the works that remain from the WPA, the Timberline Lodge in on Mount Hood outside of Portland, Oregon, for example, you can see the pride that they took in the work that they did. This was not just make work. It wasn't leaf raking. They literally rebuilt the country, but given the opportunity to make a living for themselves, they did work of exceptional quality that they really, really took pride in.
Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the history of the WPA, when the federal government put millions of unemployed Americans to work in the midst, the depths of the Great Depression. Nick Taylor is with us. He's author of the new book, American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA, When FDR Put the Nation to Work. The program formally launched in 1935. 1937, January, FDR was giving his second inaugural address, talking about, still then, about the government's responsibility to the country's poorest, and there were many, poorest citizens.
In this nation, I see tens of millions of its citizens, a substantial part of its whole population, who at this very moment are denied the greater part of what the very lowest standards of today call the necessities of life. I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little.
A third of the nation, ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished. There's FDR in 1937. Nick Taylor, describe for us, and I should say again, they're wonderful photographs, really incredible in this book, and we've got a lot of them at our website, onpointradio.org. But I'm looking at one here. This is a road being built, road work in San Francisco, and there's a line of men that stretches just as far as the eye can see, pushing wheelbarrows full of dirt. How did this work? Did unemployed people of, I don't know, every stripe and walk of life just show up, get a job ticket and be handed a shovel and a wheelbarrow?
The rules of the WPA said that you had to be eligible for relief. So you had first to certify, and only one person in every family could be on a WPA job, but you had to prove that you really didn't have any other resources. One of the rules, and the significant rule of the WPA, was that 90% of all the project budget would be spent for labor. So that accounts for how you saw hundreds of men with wheelbarrows, pushing wheelbarrows and digging with shovels, because the money for machinery and for materials and for administration just wasn't there. The WPA was a remarkably lean operation, and as you look around at the surviving WPA projects, the reason you see so many of them with beautiful native stone or perhaps cabins made out of hand-hewn logs is because the WPA had to find what materials it used on site a lot of the time. We wouldn't want to be left as the WPA's legacy with a bunch of buildings that were made out of concrete blocks or bricks. The rule that 90% of the money be spent on labor gave us beautiful legacy as well as everything else.
Let's hear from our listeners. A lot of them want to join. Hamden, Connecticut, calling in from Adam. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My name is Adam Shapiro. I'm 19. I was born and raised in Hamden, Connecticut, just north of New Haven.
Yeah.
And about 15 minutes north of New Haven, right at the edge of Quinnipiac University, is Sleeping Giant State Park, where I've gone a lot as a kid. It's a great place for families and students all over Connecticut to go. And I'm at the peak of the giant is a sleeping giant tower, which is much like a castle. It's got lots of mythic qualities about it. And it was built, actually, in 1936 by the WPA, along with a lot of trail work done there. And it's always just been a great place for families and people to go all throughout Connecticut to just get a very just a fabulous view of all of New Haven and the Sound and everything.
Adam, do you feel the ghosts of all those workers from all those years ago, you know, putting their sweat and hand labor into that when you're there?
It's funny, I do. I remember actually when my mom told me when I was about 8, 9 years old about what the WPA was and what went into it, and it's always actually kind of stayed with me there. It's a great place to go, and just knowing what everybody went through to give us this tower and everything, it's a great place to go.
Adam, thanks for that testimony there. Let's get another call from Nashville, Tennessee, and David. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. I wanted to pass along this information for, I'm an auctioneer in Middle Tennessee, and in a previous career, we provided decor for a large restaurant chain, and one of our prize finds when we could find them were long-handled shovels that were used by the WPA. They were about 8 feet in length.
Wow.
And they were used to dig the telephone poles, and you always knew it was a WPA shovel because it had WPA branded on the wooden handle.
And 8 feet long so they could get that big butt of the telephone pole deep enough.
Exactly, so they could get it down deep. It's an unusual artifact that you sometimes still find in flea markets or an occasional antique mall or something like that, but it's, you spoke of the legacy of the things that were still standing. This was sort of the legacy of the things that helped build those things that were still standing.
That's wonderful. 8 foot long WPA shovels for phone poles. David, thanks for calling with that. Jack Beatty, how about it? In the world around us, in the memory of your own family, the imprint of the WPA?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we could have survived. My father had to sleep in his car 5 days a week and come home on the weekends. But he had some food to put on the table, and boy, that made all the difference. He was a veteran of World War I. His ship was torpedoed, nearly 70 men killed. And after the war, he got bumped around a little bit. After the war, people were putting in for disability pensions. His friends said, go ahead. And he said he remembered the sight of all those coffins on the dock, at the French dock. And he said, I just can't make any money out of this. And he said, I cursed myself in that car at night, thinking to passing up that pension. I cursed myself for a fool. But, of course, he wasn't a fool. He had pride. And, not just my family. To read Ronald Reagan's biography, Jack Reagan, his dad, coming home on Christmas Eve in 1931, just in total despair. Drunk. Two years later, he's the head of the local WPA effort. Made such a difference for so many people.
Nick Taylor, how much of the physical legacy still surrounds us? Has it begun at nearly 75 years now to drop away to dust, or are we still living in a WPA world in elements?
Well, I think that. Clearly, most of the roads and bridges have probably been replaced. Not a lot of the bridges have, but they should be, along with the bridges that have been built probably less competently since then. But going back to Adam Shapiro's comment about Sleeping Giant State Park, that's the kind of thing that has survived really, really very, very well. State and city parks still have a lot of the things that were built by the WPA here in New York. Robert Moses, who was the Parks Commissioner, had used WPA labor to build 11 gigantic swimming pools, of which 10 are still in use. And as you go around the country, there are, for example, archaeological digs that now are national monuments and parks. And the WPA did a lot of archaeology, which we don't really think of as its first task. But
I remember Dixon Mounds in Illinois as a kid with the Indian burial grounds there.
Exactly
right. A lot worked on by the WPA.
What's very interesting about the WPA is that so much of the stuff that has survived were things that didn't strictly need to be done. Roads and bridges, you could argue, certainly did, but things for recreation weren't strict necessities, but because the WPA had to find jobs for so many people, we have these wonderful recreational facilities today.
There was also controversy right along the way, though, a kind of familiar American ambivalence about the government being involved in this way at this level. Even the word, as you read, the word boondoggle coming out of the WPA period itself. Tell us that story.
Well, boondoggle existed as a word, but it applied to little things like woven leather belts and key fobs and things like that.
Little handmade things from pioneer days that you needed around the house or were sort of made at home.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Or that kids would use while they were camping. But
it came to have a very different meaning during this time. How?
There were aldermanic hearings in New York, and the hearings focused on programs that were paid for by the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, predecessor of the WPA, and those things included teaching people to make boondoggles. And one of the teachers testified that he taught the making of boondoggles. Well, quickly, headlines pounced on that. The newspapers pounced on it, and the meaning changed to mean government work of little value. And, of course, that's the meaning we know for boondoggle today.
Jack, that kind of make-work reputation, the image of guys leaning on shovels, was also part of the package here, especially when it was described by its critics.
Yes, WPA was called We Piddle Around, We Poke Along. You mentioned, Nick, an anti-Roosevelt inventor announced the WPA Comfort Shovel, featured an armrest and a seat. Yes, so this was part of the attack on the New Deal, and no doubt when you went by a roadside, probably there were three or four men waving flags. But as Harry Hopkins said, maybe they were waving the flags for a reason you didn't know about. But you know what strikes me out of all this, it was a lean ship, and the physical legacy, but also the aesthetic legacy. The Santa Monica Post Office, for example, is one of the finest examples of Art Deco architecture and design, I think, in the country. That was built by just ordinary laborers. It looks like something, it's just sort of like a Renaissance palace, and it was built by people who just took pains with it, with all the local, the vernacular material and so on. And that could be multiplied. These just weren't functional places. These were places with some style and beauty that make them last even today.
You know, it's true. My sense of the country itself from, being a child in the See the USA in your Chevrolet days, you would drive around, you'd go to state parks because that's what you could afford, but they'd have these sort of wonderfully handcrafted, lovingly crafted structures and bridges and archways that gave a sense of this being a country that was handcrafted and well-loved.
Well, yeah, and again, that's because of the requirement to spend 90% of project budgets on labor, so they used what was at hand, and we're the better off for it today.
Julia's calling from Boston. Hi, Julia. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I wanted to first point out the Merritt Parkway, which is where around where I grew up in Southern Connecticut, and my dad used to drive down the parkway and tell me about the bridges that were made by the WPA, which are gorgeous Art Deco bridges, some of the bridges.
Sure.
And I also wanted to ask if maybe the WPA made Americans feel like their government cared about them and unified the country in a way that sort of helped them during, like, once we eventually got into World War II, sort of make people feel a nationalist pride that helped us through the period of World War II?
It's a good question, Julia. Thank you very much. Nick Taylor, Jack Beatty says maybe programs like this helped immunize the country against fascism itself. But what about a sense of national unity as World War II began to loom?
Well, certainly there were objections to the Roosevelt program. Conservatives always objected to the New Deal. And
to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. But as World War II approached, as Hitler began to take over parts of Europe, the isolationists held sway in the United States. Roosevelt really had to convince the American people that there was a looming danger in terms of not only Hitler and Mussolini in Italy, but the forces of Imperial Japan who had invaded China. And so it was a job of persuasion, but the approach of war was really the instrument that made Americans feel most united. And at that point, the WPA began to shift its work primarily to the military infrastructure and helping to both rebuild it and then to train in great numbers as the war got closer.
But there was political tension woven right through here. There were roads and bridges, but the arts were also involved. Nick, I wish you'd remind us of how some of the output on that front, where John Cheever and Saul Bellow and Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison were involved, and others, led into a real kind of political confrontation and the beginning of our sort of long anti-communist, maybe not the very beginning, but certainly early in a long anti-communist movement in this country.
Well, the really interesting part about the arts projects is that, of course, there's a dilemma involving art and politics, and the artists want to be unfettered in their expression, and politics tends toward correctness. So there's a natural tension there. The WPA's writing and theater projects were the most controversial. Writing because of they were just radicals in the New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, or rather the San Francisco offices, and they were always contesting about whether the Trotskyites were better than the Marxists, and a lot of work didn't get done for a long time.
But these playwrights, dramatists, painters, and others, they were also hired, given a paycheck by the WPA?
The WPA was not primarily the rules that existed that said that a person couldn't be denied a job for political purposes was to make sure that Republicans could be hired by the WPA or would not be denied jobs. That was their fear. But it also meant that socialists and communists had to be hired as well. This stalled some of the arts projects for a long time, but eventually they understood they had to do the work to get their paychecks, so the Writers Project produced this wonderful series of American guides that were republished in the 1970s. The Theater Project did some of the most remarkable theatrical work. Orson Welles and John Houseman worked for the Theater Project and produced the wonderful version of Macbeth by the New York Negro Theater Company that came to be known as the Voodoo Macbeth. The Music Project was the least controversial, but there was always tension between the arts and the politics.
Jack, it's hard to even think today when, you know, even rather minimal arts funding gets kind of booted at a time when you know, artists were employed wholesale by the government, and never mind their politics.
Never mind their politics. I mean, Diego Rivera, who I think was, at least in Mexico, a communist, he was heading up one of the big projects at LaGuardia, wasn't he? Making murals, showing American workers. And, yeah, and of course, you can get in trouble, as Nick points out, the Massachusetts Guide mentioned Sacco and Vanzetti. It gave 14 lines to it. I mean, it gave 31 lines to Sacco and Vanzetti, only 14 to the Boston Tea Party, and that set off a hoo-ha.
But honey, are you making any money? That's all I want to know. You make dates and you make trains. I can get that through my head. It's a cinch in a pinch. You could make breakfast, even make the bed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the history of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, when the federal government put millions of the unemployed to work in the midst of the Great Depression. Nick Taylor is here. He's author of the new History American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA, when FDR put the nation to work. Mildred's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Mildred. You're on the air.
Hi. Our grandparents lived in a farm on Lake Superior in northern Michigan, and it was a subsistence farm during the Depression, and we had very little money coming in. The road to the farm was always a horrible mire, and we got stuck up to the running board every time we went up to visit them. It was just frightening. And then during this WPA period, they decided to improve the road, and my grandfather worked for the WPA to help put that road in.
The road that came to his own farm.
His own farm.
It sounds like it worked out pretty well for your family, a job and a better road to the front door.
I beg your pardon?
It sounded like it worked out pretty well for your family in that case.
It did, very well. And my Uncle Billy was a CCC boy, bringing money in, too. So it worked, New Deal worked for my grandparents' family very well.
Do you remember if they felt any embarrassment being part of a public works project, or was it considered the norm at that time?
But, no, I don't think so. Billy was proud to be with the CCC, and you know, he's long gone, but his trees are still there, growing up in the big forests in northern Michigan. And then I remember when the farm was electrified by another, the REA came and brought electricity to the farm.
So there were the tax dollars at work. Mildred, thanks for that memory. Let's get another view here from Fred in Aiken, South Carolina. Fred, you're on the air.
Tom, great show. I've had the opportunity to see a number of the WPA projects, and the one that really stands out was the lodge at Mount Hood in Oregon, which is just a spectacular lodge made with these giant hewn logs. You know, I'm saying that not very long ago, I reread Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s Crisis of the Old Order, and I don't think that a lot of people realize how near this country came to a pretty radical change of government at the time of the Great Depression.
Yeah, but there was physical evidence of what was done then and an awful lot of political ferment at the same time. Fred, thanks for that. Let me get one more. Ben from Brookline, Massachusetts. Ben, you're on the air.
Howdy. I guess there's an up and a downside to everything in the universe, but my maternal grandfather was a European craftsman, a fine craftsman who apprenticed at 8 in Sicily to become a marble cutter. He was one of the top marble cutters for the San Francisco Opera House and the Metropolitan Life Insurance Building.
Wow, beautiful buildings, yeah.
Yeah, and he actually carved a teacup out of marble that looked like china. People were amazed by it, and a crucifix with a fully anatomically correct Christ figure. If you looked at it with a magnifying glass on a white Italian marble with a gold ring in it, that was only about an inch and a half high.
So what's the downside you're thinking of, Ben?
The downside was that he left my maternal grandmother $100,000 worth of gold double eagles because Europeans mistrusted fiat mm-hmm. money, paper money.
Mm-hmm.
He died at 37 in a buggy accident, and Mr. FDR, nice guy, confiscated the gold and gave it back 52 cents on the fiat dollar.
So it was what, just regular, regular taxation, or what was going on there?
Oh, well, they confiscated the gold, and they gave you back paper money, and the paper money was inflated, so she got nicked 52% of a legacy. Had she been able to keep the gold over the years, that gold became much more valuable, but gold became illegal in the
right.
United States.
But a marble cutter there finding out how policies can cut two ways and not necessarily in your favor. Nick, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Barry Bluestone. He's a professor of political economy, director of the Center for Urban and Regional Policy, dean of the School of Social Science, Urban Affairs, and Public Policy at Northeastern University, and an old friend. Barry Bluestone, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Terry.
I have to tell you, I've been listening in, and I have to tell you a little story of our family. My father, who just passed away at age 91 in November, would tell this story at the when we were kind of reminiscing about his life, that indeed my two sisters and I exist because of the WPA. My parents lived in Brooklyn, and when my father asked my mother out on her first date, on their first date, he took her to a WPA play off Broadway. I think a Clifford Odets play, and he had enough money to get them there on the streetcar, but not enough money to pay for the tickets. My mother put forward the money for the tickets. He couldn't repay her, and so he had to marry her, and that's why we're here. So thanks to Franklin Delano Roosevelt for my own existence.
Barry, take us back to that time, beyond that wonderful story of young romance there. Our caller just called in about the Timberline Lodge in Mount Hood in Oregon, how beautiful that is, but also reminded us that there was real political ferment in this country. Well, it wasn't exactly clear what the road forward would be. How do you see that kind of fluxy moment we were in then, Barry?
Well, I think it's a moment like we have today. It was a moment in which you have to remember we come out in 1932 having a very conservative president in Herbert Hoover and a decade of conservative Republicans who believed in the whole theory of a laissez-faire economy in which there was no role for government. And we transform in just a single term, really, and certainly two terms of Roosevelt, into one in which the government is seen as a partner with the private sector and absolutely necessary to sustain economic growth. We lost almost a quarter of our labor force to unemployment, and a third of our gross domestic product in the first 3 years after the stock market crash. The New Deal through 1939, before the full mobilization for the war, brought us back to where we were in 1929.
In terms of employment and gross national product.
Gross national product, exactly. And what you needed was, as John Maynard Keynes, who really was kind of behind all this theoretically, you needed to prime the pump of the economy when the economy had slowed down so much that consumers had no money to spend, investors had no reason to invest, state and local governments were forced to contract because they had to balance their budgets, And the only institution that could really move the economy was the federal government, which could borrow or print money if they had to, and pump it back into the economy. But the question was, how do you do that? And Harry Hopkins, the advisor to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt's cabinet, Frances Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, I think the first woman secretary, suggested, you know, we need to find every which way to pump this money in as quickly as we can. And the way to do that, of course, was to give it out to state and local governments to build the sidewalks, the roads, to put on the plays, to paint the murals that you've been talking about.
But is there really a parallel to today? I mean, you describe the scale of the economic downturn. Then today, you've got economists still debating whether we're even in a recession. You've got a stimulus plan, but as a you know, its relative scale far less than this, and maybe appropriately so. We've ridden out any number of recessions in recent years. What's the parallel you're seeing, Mary?
Well, I think the parallel is not about scale. It's clear that we are nowhere near the kind of depression we had in the end of the 1920s, the early 30s. But the economy has slowed down dramatically. We probably have close to zero growth. We are seeing, because of the subprime mortgage crisis, and the possibility that this could get much worse over the next few months. And the question is, what's the best way to stimulate the economy? The stimulus package that the bipartisan Congress and President Bush have put forward gives us some essentially quick tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that the stimulus we'll get out of that is probably not very strong. For one, to the extent that those tax cuts are actually spent, a good part of that's going to go for imports. That money will leave the country. The reason why a number of economists have been coming forward and saying we need kind of a mini WPA is that if we were to put money forward now, particularly sending it to states and local governments to use for the repair of public infrastructure, think about the bridge that collapsed in Minnesota last year, to repair highways, roads, mass transit, parks, schools, libraries, playgrounds. This is money that would get into the economy very quickly, but most importantly, it wouldn't leave the country. It would be here to continue to cycle through, creating more and more jobs, getting the economy stimulated so that the private sector can once again take over.
But Barry, would that really work today? I mean, we sort of picture in the 1930s that you had millions of Americans whose work may not have been far from that realm to begin with. So when you handed them a shovel or a hammer, you know, they knew what to do with it. I mean, can you really pick up America's unemployed today and put them to work rebuilding that massive bridge in Minnesota, or even fixing up the local library? Would they begin to know what to do?
Well, we do have a great number of construction workers who are already very well trained to do this.
Aren't they going to want to have union wages and hours and protections and all the rest?
Certainly, some of that will be true. But the fact is that if you put money into public infrastructure now, doing things we desperately need, states like Massachusetts have a $20 to $30 billion worth of deferred maintenance on their roads and highways and bridges, this would be the appropriate time to inject that money. The fact is that there are better times to have this kind of infrastructure investment,
mm-hmm.
and times when we really don't need it, when the economy is operating at 3.5% or 4% unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
We have a whole series of deferred projects that we could invest in rapidly to inject funds into the economy quickly, stimulate the economy, and then be able to step back from that. We don't need 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years of this. We do need it, though, right now.
Nick Taylor, could you see your friends and neighbors being rousted out to rebuild the roads and bridges in your town?
Well, my town is New York, and we're construction intense in many ways, but also we're arts intense. We have to remember that while this need exists, the people do exist to do it. The infrastructure repairs are necessary and can be dealt with, I think, by the economy that we have today. What happens during economic stimulus is that the entire economy is lifted so that people who work checkout lines and work in retail stores. People who work in insurance offices and other offices are also employed by virtue of that money that's going into the economy in terms of construction. I don't think we'll see, it's not an infrastructure need, that money should be put into the arts in the same way that it was during the WPA. So we won't see that. And, of course, as we know, New York is pretty arts intensive. But a big economic boost is going to lift not only the construction business, but the rest of the economy as well.
Let's go to Casey in Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Casey, you're on the air.
Hi, I just would like to make the comment that I find it interesting that the workers had so much dignity that they didn't want to take a handout. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to give Americans a shovel today. I think they would rather take the handout.
Interesting. Barry, what do you say?
Well, I actually think people today don't want a handout, but they do want a chance. They want an opportunity to be able to use their talents to support their families, but I think also support the country.
Even if it's a wheelbarrow, shovel, a rake.
Today it's probably not going to be the shovel. It's going to be using modern equipment. It won't be as labor-intensive as the 90% of the projects under the construction projects under WPA. But as Nick was saying, the important thing is you want to find a quick way of injecting dollars into the economy that then circulate. That construction worker who now is working 40 hours rather than 15 is spending more money at restaurants, getting haircuts, buying things in the community, and that stimulates more employment for other people. And once we could get the economy then rolling again, priming the pump, as Keynes said, then it begins to build on its own. And that's why a short-term WPA-like project, WPA-lite perhaps, today would make sense.
Let's go to Bonnie in Hyde Park, Vermont. Hi, Bonnie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom and Nick. Interesting program. There actually has been a proposal by the Obama campaign to mount a $60 billion national infrastructure bank, and this would definitely put people right to work. The dark side of this proposal is that it would allow private entities to participate.
Why is that a dark side? That's supposed to be efficiency and get it done.
Well, when you're dealing with toll bridges going into major cities as we have now, owned by foreign countries and corporations, we're actually selling American infrastructure. We would allow our tolls and bridges to be taxed by the ownership, so we would convert from where public good is bridges and roads to where those are controlled by private entities.
So there's skepticism about even getting started on it, lest it float off to foreign ownership. Jack Beatty, what do you think? When you look back at the FDA with Nick Taylor, and it's a wonderful book, wonderful photos, but do you see a lesson for now, Jack?
Well, I think that the political culture of America was stretched as far as it goes to the left in the Depression. And it has returned. Individualist assumptions have returned. Studies show that young people, you know, they don't think it's globalization. It's up to me to be competitive. And just when, in a way, leftist thinking about, you know, our interdependence and about these big structures is more relevant than ever in describing the forces impinging on us, individualism is still out there. And the myths, the cruel myths of individualism, as I think of them, still, I think, make it hard for people to see collective solutions to these things. So it's good to see our political culture stretched, but that was then, and it took the wholesale discrediting of American capitalism to bring it about.
Yeah, and the Great Depression, a pretty raw lesson. Nick Taylor, do you think Americans are just in a different state of mind today? Would they have to be whacked around Depression scale before they'd, I don't know, speak up for a program like this? Even WPA Lite, as Barry says.
Well, I don't think that we're going to go back to the kind of wholesale collective approach that we saw during the Depression, but I do think that we can be inspired by our government to act collectively, to act as one people instead of total individuals. And I think that that's what we're seeing in the presidential campaign that's going on right now.
Nick Taylor's new book is American Made, The Enduring Legacy of the WPA. Nick, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Barry Bluestone at Northeastern University. Thank you very much, Professor Bluestone.
A pleasure.
Jack Beatty, good to have you.
Thank you.
Here's Ted Lewis with Heading for Better Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's On Point. We're going to
on a choo-choo headed for better times. Oh, you know, Mr. Gloom, he won't be allowed, no, in that optimistic crowd. For this choo-choo, choo-choo is headed for better times. And listen, folks, don't pack a trunk of junk filled with yesterdays, no, no, because tomorrow, tomorrow, yes, sir, we're going to see sunshine. And you know, as we go from state to state, we'll be shouting things are great on that choo-choo, choo-choo headed for better times.